All right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Peter Buffett. He's a philanthropist, a musician, an author, and he's the cat who wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times last July that just set the philanthropic world on its ear, okay? It just turned everything upside down and said, so this is the first part of a two-part interview that I did with Peter just about a month and a half or so ago, and it's something I think you'll really enjoy, so stay tuned for both parts, all right? And as the opening segment of the show, I think it's really important that we pay attention to this. This is going to focus up around the need to close Guantanamo, and it's focused up around, or it's coming off of, a whole Close Guantanamo tour that is happening throughout January 2014. Andy Worthington, a London-based journalist, and Deborah Sweet, the national director of World Can't Wait, are both addressing how and why the U.S. has kept this illegal prison open for 12 years and our responsibility to close it. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show two of my favorite guests, and they're both on the show together this time, and Deborah Sweet, who is the national director of World Can't Wait organization, and Andy Worthington, who is a London-based journalist and author, filmmaker, and one of the foremost experts in the world on the Guantanamo prison chamber, torture chamber. And they're both involved in a tour of the U.S. right now on the 12th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo, a tour that's going around the country, focused up around Close Guantanamo Now. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. Andy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Great to be talking to you from Berkeley, which is where I am.
Well, let's jump into it now. Maybe I'll start with you, Deborah, first. Why the Close Guantanamo tour? Why Close Guantanamo Now? Why is this the demand now?
Well, you know, I remember, Michael, talking to you a year ago on January 11th, 2013, from the White House, and we were out in the field with a couple of hundred people, and we said at the time we felt so desolate. It didn't seem possible that the world was going to be brought to pay attention to the outrage that is Guantanamo. It felt like the men had been disappeared, and then with just a few weeks after the anniversary, the 11th anniversary, last February, a major hunger strike started up by the prisoners, which in a sense changed very many things. It hasn't changed everything because the prison is still open, but it forced the issue back onto the public stage, into the international media, and by heroic sacrifice and a great amount of courage, it turned out that almost the entire population at Guantanamo left, which at that point was 166 prisoners, had gone on hunger strike for much of last year. So we came to, 3 days ago, the 12th anniversary of Guantanamo, and Andy and I, who have spoken together for the last several years on the anniversary, said, you know, we have to go out bigger, and much, much more has to be done, because we really have to make this final push to close it, to force the government to close what has become symbolic of the U.S.'s contention that it can do anything it wants to anybody. I think that's the important symbolism of Guantanamo, and it's the reason that we are going across the country and speaking to everybody we can, including students this time around, to close it down, to expose what's happened there, to support the men on hunger strike, and to demand that, and we'll take this apart in the discussion, that the men who have already been cleared for release be released right away, and the other men who the government is not giving either charges or a way to get out of the prison, have those needs addressed quickly.
Mm-hmm. Andy, what about you? What do you have to say about why close Guantanamo now? Why is that the demand now?
Oh, well, I mean, it's always the demand, but on the anniversary, we get the opportunity to stress that. And, you know, 12 years is 12 years too many. The prison very obviously should never have been opened. And every day that it has been opened, it has been a disgrace for the United States, for anybody who believes in the law, anybody who believes in decency. You know, the fundamental issue for me all along, Michael, has been that you only have two routes to deprive people of their liberty. they're either criminal suspects and you charge them and put them on trial, or they're prisoners of war who were seized on a battlefield and are taken off the battlefield unmolested until the end of hostilities and protected by the Geneva Conventions. And the men in Guantanamo never were that. And now, 5 years after President Obama took office, they're still neither of those categories of prisoner. They're still a dangerous exception to the rights of people when deprived of their liberty. Men who can't get out of the prison without this, without some exceptional moves being taken. And, you know, it's a place where indefinite detention without charge or trial is the norm. That, and as I say, every day that that's been happening for 12 years ought to be completely unacceptable to any decent American people. And that's without even mentioning the torture that is part of that program and that arguably, and people say this and I do myself, that indefinite detention on that kind of scale is also a form of torture. So, you know, it's a shame every day that it's open.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I was going to ask you, well, I'll ask both of you. What, you know, I read an article, I guess Dennis Liu from World Can't Wait wrote a recent article talking about the need to close Guantanamo, the demand to close Guantanamo. And he also, in the course of that article, he pointed out that there were, you know, a lot of other torture chambers that have either been newly opened or continued to be open, like Bagram, which is a huge torture chamber, and then the secret one in Somalia. You know, that these things are actually operating and flourishing, and yet you're arguing, and or why do you think it's important in understanding that, why do you think it's important to focus people up around Guantanamo in particular?
Well, you know, I mean, I think any place of imprisonment that isn't functioning as it should do is a cause of alarm. And, you know, that was always the case in Bagram. Bagram being a frontline prison in an occupied country in the war zone should have been a place where, you know, where we were seeing a real focus on the Geneva Conventions. But it was discarded there as well. You know, most of the men in Afghanistan have been handed over to the control of the Afghans now, but there is a small number of foreign prisoners that the U.S. is continuing to hold, and they're people who have had even less rights than the men at Guantanamo. Some of them were seized 10, 11, 12 years ago in other countries and brought to Afghanistan, and they've never even had the habeas corpus rights of the Guantanamo prisoners. And when we start hearing, obviously, about other facilities in places like Somalia, then it's deeply troubling because the involvement there is either of various covert operations. I imagine that that's what we're seeing is, you know, something that's much more submerged than what's happening at Guantanamo. But they're all aspects of the same thing. If you accept at any basis that you can torture people and that you can indefinitely detain them without charge or trial, which continues to be enshrined at Guantanamo, then, you know, the knock-on effect is the same for all of these other places as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, a journalist and one of the foremost experts in the world on Guantanamo, and Deborah Sweet, the National Director of the World Can't Wait. Deborah, what about you in terms of this focus on Guantanamo? You know, this is a really big, it seems like this is something that really focuses up a lot of what's wrong, what's been going wrong in the world, what's actually been done to the world behind U.S. imperialism and its interests, you know, for the last 12 years, you know, longer than that.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking about this very question leading up to this tour and having spoken to a lot of students and other people over the last few years in particular on the question of what was so special about Guantanamo and why do we have to care so much about it? And from the other side, why is it such a bone of contention in the ruling structures of the U.S., because I do believe that Obama and others probably, when they took office 5 years ago now, almost 5 years exactly, did think, well, Guantanamo's not really helping us anymore. Let's go about this another way, and let's close it. And yet you have the Lindsey Grahams and the elements in the U.S. ruling class who absolutely stand for what Guantanamo has come to represent. They still stand on the idea that Guantanamo was the worst of the worst and that people should have no rights. So you begin to think that Guantanamo came to represent for the U.S. and for the people who are holding on to that, those sections of the ruling class that want it, as something they want to say to the world. It's a place where we could do whatever the hell we wanted to do to whoever we wanted to do it. And they could do it, and they set it up deliberately in a place where international law didn't reach, in a place that was not on the continent, under the continental control or under the war declaration of the United States, like Afghanistan. Because Bagram, yes, the reason that the Obama administration says those men have no right to habeas corpus is because it's a U.S.-declared war zone. So they don't have any right to hear charges against them. They don't have any right to have lawyers and be released. That right, to a certain extent, was won in Guantanamo through a great deal of struggle, but it hasn't proven to be very helpful to the 155 men still there. They're still in a legal black hole.
Yeah.
And this is the importance of Guantanamo right now. Shaker Amer, the last British subject there, wrote a piece on Saturday for the anniversary where he compared the International Declaration of Human Rights to the Guantanamo Declaration of No Human Rights.
Wow.
And it's true.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Andy, let me ask you this, because you've really followed this very closely. What is the situation in terms of the people that are still being held prisoner in Guantanamo? What's the situation there now? Because, you know, really for a while we were hearing there was a burst, just a sudden burst over the last year around the hunger strike, where a lot of attention got focused on Guantanamo, but then very quickly it dissipated. What's the situation now in terms of who's there? What are the conditions they're facing? What are they up against right now?
Well, you know, politically there are 155 men still held. 76 of those were cleared for release by the task force that President Obama established when he took office 5 years ago, issued their report 4 years ago. So, you know, they need releasing immediately. There's never been any excuse for them not to be freed. If you go through a process where you say you don't want to hold people anymore and then hold them year after year after year, that's just so completely unacceptable. It would make it would shame totalitarian regimes who don't throw a review process into their indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial. So they have to go. Now, the majority of those men, 55 of those 76, are Yemenis. And ever since a Nigerian man tried and failed to blow up a plane bound for Detroit with a bomb in his underwear on Christmas Day 2009, there's been an institutional resistance towards releasing any cleared Yemeni prisoners from Guantanamo, even though they had nothing to do with this man and his bomb plot. So President Obama has to act. He dropped his own ban on releasing the Yemenis, which he imposed after this bomb plot, in his major speech on Guantanamo last May, when he promised to resume releasing prisoners. He's released 11 men. He promised to appoint envoys to help with the closure of the prison in the Pentagon and in the State Department. He's done that. He dropped the ban on Yemenis. He's done that, but he hasn't released any of them. So we really need to push for the release of these men. And the next thing that we need people to remember is it's not just the cleared prisoners, it's everybody else still there. That's 79 men, and the majority of these are not going to face trials. They're being held indefinitely without charge or trial, and the only thing that can help them is a review process that's been put in place, which is moving very slowly, that people need to look at, called the periodic review boards, which I've written about. People can Google periodic review boards, and I encourage people to look at it. There is a ban on moving prisoners to the U.S. mainland for any reason still in place, imposed by Congress. And the president, one way or another, will need to break through that to bring a smaller number of people as possible, the ones who aren't released, to the U.S. mainland to face trials, to, if necessary, face new legal challenges to establish if there are any grounds on which it can be argued that they should be held. But Guantanamo can't close without that happening. The other helpful thing, I think, for people to think about this year is that it's going to be the drawdown of troops from Afghanistan, which technically will mean that the conflict in connection with which the prisoners were seized will be coming to an end. And the justification for holding them, which has always been extremely dubious, but has been relied on by the U.S. government, the authorization for use of military force passed immediately after the 9/11 attacks, will look very shaky indeed at that point. So we need to be pushing is to say to the government, your excuses are running out. Everybody must be freed by the end of this year, except for anybody that you can genuinely charge with crimes.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, a journalist and one of the foremost experts in the world on Guantanamo, and Deborah Sweet, the national director of The World Can't Wait. Now, Deborah, one of the things that you've said is that in relation to Guantanamo, it's not a politician problem, it's a system problem. And I want to talk to you about how that plays out in relation to what you were just saying, like the idea that, okay, it's possible that Obama really does want to just like get this out of his hair, close it down, do whatever, and that there's all this opposition from all these other various fascistic and right-wing, you know, politicians and whatnot. But, you know, there is something that keeps coming up, I think, in terms of, you know, where people focus on this as if it's just simply a politician problem and not seeing the relationship between why Guantanamo was established, why it's open, and the needs of the system. And in particular, I was thinking about, too, this whole idea that, I mean, here you have the president, right, the most powerful tyrant in the history of the world, you know, frankly, in the sense of everything that's at his disposal. And he can't say, hey, to hell with you guys, I'm closing it down.
Yeah, well, I'm not the only one to have pointed it out that when Obama began to use targeted killing and drones in early 2009, he never had to go to Congress. He, in fact, didn't. He did it under a secret program. He used his executive authority to do what was most necessary, in that case something that, in fact, possibly distracted from the process of closing Guantanamo, because they were making decisions to kill people rather than indefinitely detain them. But the point here I'm making overall is that Obama made a decision to do something without Congress. Clearly, he could do this again. But I think many times we get hung up on Obama, what he wants to do or doesn't want to do. I don't know. I do see, and we have been living for 12 years, under the threat of increased repression, now we know about all the vast surveillance, of a completely illegitimate, unjust, immoral series of wars and threats in this so-called war on terror. And that's what has been the dominating factor. So I think we shouldn't get hung up on what it is Obama or any other politician wants to do. What changes things always, and this is why Andy is doing his work and World Can't Wait and others and people fasting in Washington this past week gathered in front of the White House, was to build essentially what we need, a mass movement among people living in this country who says, no, we won't accept this being done in our name. That's the main dynamic factor, I think, that could change this. And we are very excited that this tour got invited to Stanford. Andy was there last night, and we'll be in L.A. and then in Anaheim and at CSU Pomona, all trying to reach different sections of people about Guantanamo, including, you know, a big working-class campus where a lot of people might not know that much about Guantanamo but are going to get to interact with Andy, and the journalist Jason Leopold is also coming along on the tour, having just returned from Guantanamo, which is very exciting to have word from somebody who was physically there just last week will be very important for people to understand how real this is and how much of a challenge it is for us to keep the struggle. And as we've said, it's 12 years, but we are not stopping.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, Andy, one of the things I want to hear from you a little bit about what you found on the tour so far, but I also wanted to ask you first, you've been one of the major, basically people bringing to life the condition of the prisoners. And in particular, you've been one of the major voices bringing out the story of Shachar Amer, who Deborah referred to earlier. And I understand he has actually recently announced that despite of it, what seems to be a pretty heavy-handed cover-up by the mainstream media, that there is, once again, a hunger strike among a section of the people being detained and held in Guantanamo. Can you tell us a little bit about that and Shachar Amer's situation right now?
Yeah, sure. I mean, You know, I mean, I think the mainstream media lost a certain amount of interest after focusing on the issue for quite a long time last year. I don't really want to hit them too hard at the moment. It was primarily the Pentagon and the authorities at Guantanamo that decided that the best way to silence interest in the hunger strike was to stop reporting it, which they did on December the 2nd. They said, we're no longer going to issue reports on how many people are on a hunger strike, therefore effectively silencing any way of anyone knowing about it officially. But, you know, the news is going to come out of the prison through the prisoners themselves. And the foremost person for doing that at the moment, who really reports in from inside Guantanamo on a regular basis with fantastic insight and eloquence, is Shaka Arma, the last British resident. So in the last few days, he's been reporting, and other prisoners actually have been, Reprieve in London, the legal action charity that represents prisoners, including Shaka, have been compiling comments made to lawyers by the prisoners over the last few weeks, and coming to the conclusion that there are currently 33 men on a hunger strike and that the numbers are rising. So we're going to hear about it, even if the administration doesn't want to let us know. And it seems in that way to be replaying what happened with the media last year, where the prison-wide hunger strike started. The prisoners were reporting it to their lawyers, and for several weeks, the authorities maintained that there were only five or six men on hunger strike until they couldn't maintain the illusion anymore. So we're kind of seeing a repeat of that. The prisoners are putting the pressure back on. And I don't think that there's any way that they're going to maintain absolute silence unless they silence all the lawyers. And I don't actually genuinely think that they're going to try and do that. So the problem for Shaka Arma is that here's this man who, as I say, his reports are so powerful and so eloquent, you know, that in a just world they would be on the... Well, in a just world, Guantanamo wouldn't be open, but if we were to look at a responsible media, his stories would be on the front page of newspapers every day, would be, how the hell is this happening? Look at this man. Why is he held? He's been cleared for release under Bush. He's been cleared for release under Obama. He's fantastically eloquent. Now, he knows a lot about what's happened, so the presumption is always that they don't want to release him because he'll embarrass them. And that is probably true of both the British and the American governments. But it goes on and on and on, not releasing him. And it's a great shame, because all that pressure that the prisoners exerted last year and everybody getting involved in the outrage and the million people signing online petitions and all of this has only so far led to the release of 11 men. And, you know, Shaka Arma isn't one of them. I don't mean to put him as somebody more important than all the rest of the prisoners. But, you know, there's never been any noticeable obstacle to his release in terms of opposition in Congress. They've always opposed the release of prisoners to countries they regard as dangerous. Britain is not a country regarded by the United States as a dangerous country. So he should be released. And it's just part of the horrible injustice, I think, really, Michael, that although even with this pressure that's put on, The pressure is still not sufficient to oblige the government of the United States to do everything that it needs to do to redress the things that are happening. They can still, with impunity apparently, carry on holding this very publicly acknowledged man who they've said repeatedly they don't want to hold.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, a journalist and one of the foremost experts in the world on Guantanamo, and Deborah Sweet, the national director of The World Can't Wait. Andy, we're coming up on close to the end of our time, but I wanted to ask you a question, and then I'll pose the same one to Deborah. And it's kind of it'll be two questions, but the first one is this. You know, if you were to talk to people, and what you say to people on this tour, what's the message that you feel you need to drive home every time you speak to people, and that people need to leave any interaction with you feeling and understanding?
I suppose really it's some of the things that I mentioned in our show today, really. That indefinite detention is unacceptable without charge or trial. It's unacceptable under any circumstances. It's happening every day at Guantanamo, has been for 12 years. For American people, they need to reflect on the fact that this is being done in their name every day of the week and has been for 12 years, and it needs to be brought to an end. You know, the other thing is just remember what the government has said itself about these people. Half of them, it said 4 years ago, didn't want to hold, and it's still holding them. What message could that possibly send to anybody that law and justice and truth and fairness mean anything? And, you know, and then the other half of the men who are held there, look at these men. If they're not going to be put on trial, ask on what basis people who have been so abused are regarded by the United States as people who are too dangerous to release, but they don't have enough evidence to prove that publicly. It all indicates that just the terrible, terrible place that Guantanamo is, and the I hope that people, when they recognize that, realize how damaging it is for it to stay open. Every day that it stays open is horrendous.
Deborah, the same question to you.
Well, Andy really encouraged us to show on this tour a film called Doctors on the Dark Side, which is about the role of medical professionals in the enhanced interrogation, the force feeding, all allowing the military to get away and the CIA to get away with what it did in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, Bagram, and the black sites and so forth. And I was really impressed with the questions this film is raising, because I think in a broader sense the question of complicity and responsibility is one everybody living in this country really has to face up to. If we don't condemn it, if we don't stop it, in a sense we're going along with it. And this applies, of course, to many things. There's a whole epidemic of mass incarceration. This country is the number one jailer of the world. But that epidemic is very much tied in with what the military has done in Guantanamo. And we've got to dig into it deeper all the time, take it apart, expose it, and oppose it. It is not just the principle of the thing with Guantanamo for us. It's also the 155 men left there, all of those individuals, and what this says about humanity that's really important about Guantanamo. And, again, going out very widely to the public as part of this tour, people can look at worldcan'twait.net. They'll be able to see some of the video of Andy and others speaking and hear the stories. And I think this provides at least an opening for anyone who wants to know what's going on, and we're giving them things to do about it as well.
All right. And Andy, can you give people, as we go out, can you give people the way, your websites?
Yeah, sure. I would be delighted for people to come and find my website, andyworthington.co.uk. I've been writing there on an almost daily basis about Guantanamo since May 2007. So there's a vast wealth of information there. And I'm also the co-founder with the attorney Tom Wilner, who argued the Guantanamo prisoners' cases successfully before the Supreme Court in 2004 and 2008, of a website, a campaigning website called closeguantanamo.org. And that does what it says in the name, which is it's a website devoted to working towards the closure of Guantanamo.
All of these websites are very valuable for anybody who gives a damn about what's happening in the world and who cares about humanity. Andy, Deborah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Deborah Sweet from The World Can't Wait and Andy Worthington, a London-based journalist who's one of the foremost experts in the world on the Guantanamo torture chamber. And we've been talking about a tour going around the country right now demanding close Guantanamo down now, all right? We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to an interview I did with Peter Buffett, philanthropist, musician, author, and all-around hellraiser, as it turns out. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was Already Flown from Peter Buffett. And check this out. That song was actually what led to, many years after the song was written, it's what inspired Peter's op-ed piece, The Charitable Industrial Complex. All right, and that is all about what the hell is going on with philanthropy and how it's feeding the beast and not solving the problem. Peter Buffett is a musician, composer, author, and philanthropist, and Peter's joining us to talk about this today. Peter, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
As I was saying, when I read the op-ed piece, so much was in there that I thought was so important in terms of people facing a world today that's just so horrifying and wanting to do good in the world, but trying to figure out how the hell do you do that? You know, it's like a very difficult situation to deal with.
Yeah.
And your piece, just so everybody can be on the same page for people who haven't seen it, what are we talking about here? What were you talking about in that piece? And then we'll dig into some of the particulars as we go along.
Well, I think maybe what affected people so much is I was coming at it from an observer status as opposed to expert status. I was coming at it from a level of, I mean, it was sort of, you know, does anybody else see what I'm seeing kind of thing, and not claiming anything other than that to some extent, and saying that ultimately it appeared that a lot, not all of, but a lot of philanthropy, and this is done by well-meaning people, again, this is not some nefarious thing out there, but it's, you know, that a lot of philanthropy is keeping the existing structures of inequality in place. I mean, that's really the shorthand of it. And then I went into a few examples, but I even didn't want to get into that. I wanted to talk about kind of bigger issues around being in a room where you've got a head of state or a head of a bank or a head of a philanthropic organization, and it seems like they're trying to fix with one hand what the other hand did, and those kinds of things. So that's really what I was addressing.
Well, one of the things in terms of what you were saying about wanting to, you know, basically asking the question, is anybody else seeing what I'm seeing? And you really looked at reality as it is. And tried to deal with that, tried to assess, well, why is that happening? You know, and I wanted to ask you, what led you to being able to do that, to actually doing that? And what did you see that took you to the conclusion that you drew?
Well, you know, a lot of it, and it really does stem from the Emperor Has No Clothes story that, you know, we all used to love as a kid. And a lot of it is really staying in touch with that five-year-old kid that saw on a black and white television, you know, people in Selma turning hoses on other people, you know, and you go, what the hell? You know, what? I don't get that at all. And so if you can keep that alive in you a little bit and say it out loud, you know, me being 55 now instead of five, I mean, that's really what did it. And the fact that I had parents that had those same questions and were even in Omaha, you know, really trying to do what they could or learn what they could about why there was so much inequality and why people didn't treat each other like humans.
That's the question that people have to take a look at in the world. But there's a lot of people that do look at that in different ways. I mean, look, I traveled a lot through the third world over the years. And you know, you look at the conditions and there's constantly this thing of sort of, you know, you look at the conditions people are living under and or barely living under or, you know, basically attempting to live under.
Yeah. And under is the operative word, by the way.
Right. Yeah. Well, well, let's talk about that because I think that, you know, to me, I was wondering if that sort of perception, I know you've seen a lot of the world, and there's a certain thing when you're confronting the reality, there's a certain thing that really comes up. Yes, there's the point when you were a kid and looking at, like, why are people hungry? Why does it have to be this way? I thought you made a good point in one piece I read where you said how you always remember as a kid your parents saying to you, eat that because there are people starving in other parts of the world. And you kept thinking, why? Why are so many people starving?
Right, exactly.
But then we see it, you know, when you go and you see this thing, what were the kinds of things that you saw? And people don't necessarily get what it looks like in these places where people are so desperately under the gun in a lot of ways, you know, metaphorically as well as actually.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because you can look at two sides of the story when you go to these places. Certainly the depth of, I guess, what one person will do to another, and it's no more stark than seeing a 13-year-old girl being sold for sex. I mean, that's the bottom, and there's a few things that are down there, I suppose, with that, but I don't think there's anything worse than that. And you see, you know, there's all sorts of darkness, but really what's extraordinary is the resiliency, you know, the fact that people can get through amazing things, you know, and to switch from victim to survivor, essentially, and then to respect that and figure out how to not let that happen again and what were the mechanisms that caused it. And you sort of trace everything back to so many layers. I mean, there's no single villain or no single, you know, answer in all of this, but so many layers of disconnection and turning everything into a transaction and anything in that category creates these things, and it all seems fundamentally false when you step back far enough and say, again, why do we have to create systems that cause this much inequality and worse, really? And you come back asking those questions a lot, that's for sure.
You know, I was thinking about this too, because you became a philanthropist and then started to see a lot of what you were trying to do in the world. And how did that jive with your ability to actually do something about the problems and the horrors you saw in the world? How did that jive with actually what the reality was?
Well, you do, I think, you can't help if you really go. And after I finally went, which was in about 2007, and when I say went, I mean to places I'd certainly never been before and hadn't seen people in the situations that I'd seen then in Liberia or Sierra Leone or Bangladesh or India or certain countries and certain sections of countries. And you really come back realizing that you want to, at least we want to, go as far kind of upstream as we can in terms of thinking about how these problems got started. And even in a simple way, it means when you go to Liberia with this high-minded thought of education and educating girls in particular, and then you get there and you realize there aren't roads that are passable to many places. And so forget about books or paying the teachers or the fundamentals of education. You got to get there first. And so you go, whoops, let's back this up a little bit. And that's what you see in all sorts of ways throughout the world, really, not just the developing world, but right here in New York, you ask the same questions. You know, why is it that we have a school system in the heart of the Hudson Valley, which is one of the largest apple-growing areas in the country, and the kids are eating apples from China, you know, because of how little the school can spend per student on a lunch program? I mean, you start to dissect this stuff, and not that there's anything wrong with apples from China, I have no idea, but the fact is there's one down the street. It's just amazing, the matrix of control and kind of the systemic failure of so many things in ways. And yeah, it can get a little overwhelming, I guess, but you got to work where you can and where you think you can make a difference.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Buffett, musician, composer, author, and philanthropist, and the author of an op-ed piece in the New York Times called The Charitable Industrial Complex, and a man who basically forced open a discussion that is long overdue. Now, Peter, one of the things in the beginning of your piece, you talk about the idea of philanthropic colonialism, and it kind of struck me, and you know, I wanted to know what you meant about that. And you became, and in addition to sort of talking about that, you also talked about you soon became aware that much more damaging things were going on than what you thought.
Yeah, and that really stems initially, because that was a thought I had early on when we got into the larger scale philanthropy in 2006 and 2007. That term came to me, and it did because, first of all, I was quite involved with the American Indian culture for about a decade or more. I happened to score a little piece in Dances with Wolves, and that led to a big score with this show, this eight-hour show called 500 Nations. And I just kept learning more and more and getting deeper and deeper in the present and the past in terms of the American Indian culture, and was just, you know, sort of, first of all, blown away by what I didn't learn at school. I think that's starting to change a little more, but the truth of how the country was founded and developed and grew. And so the idea of culture and, you know, specific people, you know, it's easy sometimes you say culture, it sort of glosses over the fact that these are human beings that got crushed in an effort to, you know, impose a different sort of system on it. I mean, it's just an easy way of saying it all quickly. But you could see that with philanthropy that wasn't even good intention, not even poor, you know, but maybe poorly thought through, could go into another culture, another part of the world, even other towns or something, and impose what they think is a beautiful solution to a problem that they fundamentally don't know how it got started or what it's really about. But it worked for them, so it should work for somebody else. And they go in and try it, and it can wreak havoc in big and small ways, again, unbeknownst to the person that's certainly well-meaning and trying to do a good thing, but is completely missing it in another part of the world.
Yeah, and then you said, though, that there was something more damaging going on. You saw it was more than just sort of random decisions or random decision-making that didn't fit the places that they were being made for and all. But you saw something more damaging happening. What was that?
Well, now you're really getting to the point, and that's the real concern is that, and this was illuminated by a friend of mine. I hadn't really thought about it this far, but that, in fact, there can be systems in place that keep things just okay enough, you know, and that's one of the potentially more damaging things, that philanthropy, in a sense, and I mentioned this in the article, keeps the pot from boiling over. I mean, it keeps things, it keeps people just fed enough or healthy enough or whatever it might be to keep from really any kind of a larger scale or a united revolt in some way. And that doesn't have to be, you know, violent, but it can be united enough to make a difference in a way a country's behaving, the way a corporation in a country's behaving. Things that seem to be creating this inequality on a massive scale, certainly in various African countries, but also here and all sorts of places. You know, if you keep everybody just fed enough, whatever it might be, that nobody will really rise up and say, this has got to change.
I wanted to read these paragraphs. I was really struck by these two paragraphs, okay?
Sure, yeah.
And it's the points that you're just talking about. This. It says, as more lives and communities are destroyed by the system that creates vast amounts of wealth for the few, the more heroic it sounds to give back. It's what I would call conscience laundering, feeling better about accumulating more than any one person could possibly need to live on by sprinkling a little around as an act of charity. But this keeps the existing structure of inequality in place. The rich sleep better at night while others get enough to keep the pot from boiling over. Nearly every time someone feels better by doing good on the other side of the world or street, someone else is further locked into a system that will not allow the true flourishing of his or her nature or the opportunity to live a joyful and fulfilled life. That's a pretty heavy concentration of what's going on.
Wow, you're right. You know, it's funny because I had to read it again a few weeks after I wrote it because I thought, what the heck happened here? And now when you read it again, especially when I'm not looking at the words on the page, yeah, that's a fairly potent little bit of stuff there. No, I mean, occasionally I'll write something. I mean, often it happens with songs where I'm just kind of, you know, you kind of put your brain on the shelf and let something else come through you the best you can. And, you know, the op-ed was really one of those things. And that couple of paragraphs there, as far as I'm concerned, says a lot, obviously. I mean, that's because I wrote it, about where we are and what's really going on. And I think that's probably why the op-ed worked so well, because I wasn't someone thinking about this. I was feeling it. I was absorbing it sort of over a 7-year period. And, you know, like I said, some of the things came early, like the philanthropic colonialism idea, and some of them really just coalesced around the last, I would say, year or so, when I'd been to enough conferences, I've been to enough places, I've talked to enough people where it just, the truth is, I'm a songwriter first. And so it more reflects the fact that it was a feeling piece, not a thinking piece. And I think that's why so many people were affected by it, because it was that. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't trying to be correct in any way, because feelings matter, period, right? So I was just putting it out there, and you could take it or leave it. And, you know, the big surprise was so many people really did respond to it in a positive way.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Buffett, philanthropist, musician, composer, and author of the New York Times op-ed piece, The Charitable Industrial Complex. Well, let's continue on in this vein. You mentioned earlier about sitting in a room and you got access to all these places. You know, suddenly when you had a foundation and you were invited to all these things to sit down in, and you saw this point about the same people at different times seeking to solve the problems and other times are actually the cause of the problem. How did that impact you?
Well, you know, I was, first of all, lucky to have the parents I have, and I came from the family I came from. I mean, I joke about the fact that my great-grandfather's name was Ernest and his brother's name was Frank, you know, so I come from Frank and Ernest. But, you know, there's a certain kind of Midwestern integrity, which I won't say is perfect by any stretch. I mean, it's not that it was this pillar of, you know, perfect alignment or anything, but at the same time, I saw my dad live his life in a pretty clear and integrity-filled way. And so when you're in a room with people where it's sort of standard operating procedure to give a wink and a nod, or I'll give you this if you give me that, and you know, the kind of horse trading that happens in a variety of ways. But we're talking about people's lives as well as obscene amounts of money, and I'm not saying I know anything that anybody else doesn't. You look in the papers and you see this stuff all the time, but I didn't grow up with it. And so when you're in the room with it and you start to see that, again, there's this veneer of I'm trying to do good now that I've made $500 million. It's like, but wait a minute, where did that come from? And what's the deal with hanging on to all that? And let's talk about how much the person that cleans your toilets gets paid. I mean, that's what kills me, is you've got these people that are doing jobs all over the country, not to mention the world, that nobody else wants to do. Shouldn't they get paid a lot for that as opposed to the least? That's the kind of stuff that confuses me.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Buffett, musician, composer, author, and philanthropist, and the author of an op-ed piece in the New York Times called The Charitable Industrial Complex. Now, Peter, one of the things I wanted to ask you, though, in relation to this conscience laundering, you know, there's a point here where you talk about keeping the existing structures of inequality in place. You also say in other places that there's no amount of humanitarian intervention that can actually solve these problems that you see posed in huge swaths of the world. And whether it's the sex trade in children and women, whether it's the just rampant disease. I mean, I interviewed somebody a few weeks ago on this, about this film called Fire in the Blood. And you're confronted with this situation of how do you, you know, it was AIDS in Uganda and then the rest of Africa. And then the idea of how do you actually get the medication that people can afford that would be affordable and could and is available and could be made available broadly if it wasn't for intellectual property rights or various restrictions and things. And millions of people, literally 10 million people dying because they couldn't get that medicine. And then as soon as somebody actually got the medicine and made it cheap and made it for $1 a day to treat people, all these people coming to life in really amazing ways. And then you're sitting there watching, you're thinking, wow, no matter what this intervention does, it's sort of like you can talk about the infant mortality rate getting better, but these infants are then growing up in a world where death is stalking them at every move.
Well, exactly. And lives for what? I mean, again, I think I've either said this in the op-ed or I wrote it and it got edited out because we only had 800 words. But of course, what life isn't worth saving except that if it's a life that gets crushed by the very system that said, here, I'm going to save you, what's that? You know, I mean, again, way smarter people can talk about the various details of this than I can, but that's the question is, yeah, these lives are being saved, and that's important and amazing, but then we got to figure out how they can flourish and actually feel alive.
One of the things, though, and in terms of keeping the structure of inequality in place, you know, one of the things that used to get me really angry is I would go into these countries, and whether I was in Sri Lanka after the tsunami, and I was in Mexico, and you know, back in '94, and I spent a lot of time in South Africa and Southern Africa in the '80s, and you know, one of the things that were always happening, it was like an army of NGOs, these non-governmental organizations, who had everywhere where they were looking, and they would you know set up little things that could be sort of social welfare things.
Right.
But not only could they not solve the problem, but they were actually establishing a kind of buffer between the problem and the solution. What do you think about this?
Yeah. No, I mean, they're in business to help, but the business sort of comes first. And again, these are well-meaning people, and some of these organizations can do great things. And it was hard in the op-ed because I'm speaking broadly, and certainly there are, you know, there's amazing things going on. So I have to always throw that in as a caveat. But there's also the other side of it, where who wouldn't want purpose and a paycheck? Who wouldn't want to know that they could pay their rent and feed themselves and also do something meaningful? Who wants to lose that job? Who in the NGO side or the foundation side gets up and says, gee, how can I lose my job today for real? And that's understandable. People need jobs. But it sets up an underpinning of, well, yeah, we want to help, but if we help too much, then what are we going to do? And that's a very odd little nut to crack there.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Buffett, philanthropist, musician, composer, and author of the New York Times op-ed piece, The Charitable Industrial Complex. There's a point that you made in relation to this whole thing again, the point you spoke to about keeping the pot from boiling over. How do you see that fitting into all this?
You know, what I'm hoping, and this may get into more of kind of solutions and what we're trying to do at Novo, and just what I'm feeling personally is that, you know, I'm hoping there can be a way through philanthropy or just good works in general to sort of knit together people, and it's happening. I mean, this is going to happen no matter what, but I hope it can be done in kind of a nonviolent and evolutionary way, so we don't have to put the R in front. Maybe that's not so scary then. But knit together so many disenfranchised people into a somewhat more unified voice, although, again, you know, you have to respect the differences too. It's always a tricky balance, but a unified voice in terms of just fundamental humanity and living conditions and living wages and again, how people treat each other. And so I think if the pot has to boil over, I hope it's kind of a slow boil and it doesn't quite, you know, because something's got to give, I think. And I, again, that's just the way cultures and history works, is there's some cyclical aspect to it. And we're certainly, I think, feeling something of a cyclical nature. If you look back to the progressives in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there's a lot of similarities. So there's a lot of possibilities that maybe we can get it a little more right this time, because in 1860, it was very different for, you know, an African-American in the South than it is now. Is it perfect? Not by a long shot. But we're moving in the right direction, you know, the whole arc of justice thing, or Ben Stewart's justice. So, yeah, the pot from boiling over it could be the issue of the day or of our time. I don't know whether that time is 10-year arc or a 50-year or a 100-year, but something has to shift so more people feel like they're included in, you know, where we're headed as a global society at this point.
Well, a couple of things on that, because one of the things I was actually trying to, you know, speak to the point that you raised about so much of philanthropy actually involves really trying to keep the pot from boiling over. And it seems like, in a certain sense, I mean, from my perspective, it seems, I think the pot has to boil over.
Right. I agree. You know? No, I agree. And I think that's where, and I was really trying to get at that in a gentle way when I said I'm not calling for an end to capitalism, but a call for humanism. What I'm hoping is we can kind of jump the conversation up a level, because honestly, I think if you call for humanism, capitalism has to shift tremendously from what it is now. So, but instead of getting stuck in names for economic, social, political systems, let's kick it up a notch and talk about how we want to treat each other. And then maybe some of those things will improve, again, without maybe a larger social upheaval in the traditional way. You know, maybe the pot boils over, because I think it does. I agree. It has to. But maybe it's different than we might have imagined it boiling over during the French Revolution or something.
Well, let me pose this to you, because one of the things that made me a revolutionary was the fact that I kept seeing this sort of the recurrence of, you know, people going and they're trying to do things and they're intervening and there's all these humanitarian interventions and all this, but there's a much deeper rooted problem going on. And when you're looking at how all these things play out, like, for instance, the fact that, you know, in Thailand, there are no longer, or at least, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, there were no longer any little girls in the villages because they were all sold into the sex trade. Or you look in Africa where they try to bring in medication for the diseases, but there's no food for people to take the medication and keep it down. So there's all this multi-layered, very thorough, systemic and systematic thing in operation here. And I'd say you do have to call it capitalism in terms of this,
right?
This very ruthless profit above everything, and everything else serves the god of profit. And that sort of shapes a world that I don't think you can get rid of short of a revolution.
Right. And I don't disagree. It's just, what does revolution look like in the early 21st century? And that's what I'm going to say I don't know, as opposed to it's got to be the versions that we've seen before. And I don't know the answer. I'm not saying, oh my gosh, we can't get violent if violence is the only way, but I don't think that's the only way. So I am not going to say that, because I think that, you know, that's been the issue, is we get pulled into this polarized place. And I'm going to hold out the hope and belief, which is this, I guess, means that there's a possibility it isn't true, but I'm going to hold it out that, in fact, we can create a revolution, a turning, a shift, a transition into something that hopefully won't hurt anybody, and at the most, or at certainly at worst, is somewhat on the mildly chaotic scale as opposed to the intensely, because we're a world community now. This is the only thing that's really different. We've seen things like this before. And again, you go back 100 and some years, and it felt an awful lot like this. Go back another 100 or so, and it felt an awful lot like this again. And so, you know, Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And, you know, we're in a rhyming spot, I think. But how can we learn from the past and maybe do it a little bit better, a little bit smarter, a little bit less painful? But maybe I'm naive. You know, maybe pain is part of it. I can't, you know, I can only hope.
Well,
I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's actually the problem. And ironically, I think it's a problem that you're dealing with and what you're talking about in your op-ed piece, but also in a lot of the blogs that you've written. You know, the fact that it is a world where pain is routinely inflicted on the vast majority of people, you know?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, in fact, the minute I completed that sentence, I realized, well, the truth is there's plenty of pain happening right now. And so to think that it's going to happen without pain is to say it's not already happening, because that is correct, and it's too many. And so in that sense, it can't happen without pain because, yeah, there's too much of it.
Yeah. Well, you and I'll come back to this many times in the future, okay?
Yeah, I look forward to it.
Yeah,
definitely,
me too.
Because we're in the midst of it for sure. I joke with people, I don't know whether it's 1720 or 1760 or 1690, but it's, you know, I'm sure people felt like this before.
Well, yeah, it felt like it. And actually right now that I really think that there's a possibility, there's a need for doing this, and there's actually the possibility of this. And, you know, I know I had sent you some stuff about written by Bob Avakian and the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this is, you know, that's what I think a lot of what he's worked on, the work that he's done on that, including, you know, a whole new synthesis of communism, the possibility for a whole different world. You know?
Right, exactly. So, and that's what people, you know, there's words that carry these scary connotations because we were fed the scary connotations
for so long.
And, and we don't step back and realize it's an evolutionary process. And, you know, many people, and you know way more than I do about this, but knew that socialism, communism, these were things that would evolve out of potentially capitalism, and probably. And that's to say that may be what happens. I would expect something like that to happen.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Peter Buffett, musician, composer, author, and philanthropist, as well as the co-chair of the Novo Foundation. And we've been talking about his op-ed piece in the New York Times, where he basically said that, look, there's a charitable industrial complex that's actually really just only perpetuating the suffering of the people in the world. All right, I'm the host and producer of the show, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with musician, composer, philanthropist Peter Buffett. And I want to thank my other guests today, Deborah Sweet and Andy Worthington. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we have taken it so close to the wire that I don't even have time for a song today. So we're just going out with Talk to You Again Next Week.